Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic. We are actually coming back with the same guests we had in our previous episode, which I'm excited to do. We've got a new topic, but bringing in our guests, and I'll let Sam kind of go through and do a quick intro. We recorded this at the same time, so there won't be an opening weather segment like we usually do, but we'll get into our quick our guests and our topic, and I'm going to lead it off.
There we go. So we got our Dr. Joe. Hi, Dr. Joe, again.
Hey, everybody. Good to see you again.
And we got Kyle and Becky. And Kyle, this particular discussion will be, you know, all you too, since you're in that environment. Becky always learns something new, and I love that. We also have Mr. James Corbin and Dave Bremson, and they are wilderness medicine specialists. And Mr. Corbin, one thing you said to me when we started chatting was you kind of are leaving the wilderness medicine piece aside for now. And I want you to talk about that a bit.
Yeah. So when I first got involved in wilderness medicine, it was 1999. We were worried about the Y2K bug the year I really jumped with both feet into wilderness medicine. Started in the Shenandoah Mountains of the East Coast. Did search and rescue out there for 2-3 years. I moved out to Arizona, joined a very high-end mountain rescue team, and that was all throughout going back to school for my prerequisites and then my PA schooling. I like to joke that I rescued my way through PA school. So very frequently we'd be in lecture and all of a sudden I would just get up and leave. And the next day everyone was, where were you? I was like, oh, there's a guy stuck on the side of the cliff. So I went. And then on graduating from PA school, I moved to Micronesia for a year, did tropical medicine, dive medicine, moved back to Tucson, joined a second non-rescue team. And so I was on both the Phoenix Mountain Rescue Team as well as the Tucson Mountain Rescue Team. And I had started working doing trauma neurosurgery, doing emergency medicine on the side. My joke at the time was I had two jobs. I was on two mountain rescue teams. Thank God I only had one wife.
And she didn't see much of you, apparently.
Exactly. But all this is to set up that, like, this has really been a core of, it's something that I've just truly enjoyed doing, all for the intrinsic benefit. I love being in the backcountry. I love being able to I was in a previous lifetime, I was a rock climbing guide. So I love being able to merge, you know, my experience with rope systems, my knowledge of medicine, my just be able to build my ability to kind of navigate and operate in really austere conditions. And it's important to note there are very few people who can, if you say to them, we need you to go out, you're going to be unsupported for at least 24 hours, possibly 48, in austere environment, in you know, very bad weather. Oh, and you may encounter a seriously sick or injured person, then you need to take care of them. That skill set is pretty small. There are not very many people who can do that. And I'm not talking about myself here. I'm talking about all of the SAR professionals, you know, around the country and certainly around the world. So it got to the point where I was the head of medical training for the Tucson Mountain Rescue Team. And we were in the midst of changing our training from one medical cert to the other. And I'm going to be very vague about this because the details don't really matter. I mean, it's the Tolstoy line where, you know, every happy family is the same. Every unhappy family is unique. And there was a big fight about it. There was a lot of debate. There was a lot of older, more senior members that had come up in one system that were not, you know, not sold, not happy, you know, having just not excited about the change. And so it was a huge lift. It was a lot, but it was a lot of administrative work. There were a lot of board meetings. There was a lot of email. I'm sure everyone on the call now is sort of nodding their head because you've been there, you've experienced this. It's the not fun part of the job. It's the not fun part of, and it's all uncompensated. Every single minute that you spend doing that, you're not doing something you like, you're not doing training, you're not spending time with your family. And but we finally got it pushed through, and this was actually right before I left for my initial stint in West Africa. I was gone for about a year and a half. I stayed in touch over email and text. And then when I came back to Tucson, the whole thing blew up. A number of more senior members of the team had gotten onto the board and basically just ripped the Band-Aid off, went back to revisit the whole thing. And I was actually up in Phoenix with David, doing, David runs a consulting, company, Safe Mind, does a lot of, security training. And I was coming back, it's about a 2-hour drive and I was, you know, standard road trip, just thinking. And I realized I don't want to do search and rescue anymore. I don't enjoy being in the backcountry. I don't enjoy, just none of it is fun. And this is something we see a lot in PTSD and stress reaction. It's called anhedonia. And it's a hallmark of, you just don't enjoy doing the things that you used to do. You know, if you used to really, you'd go fishing every weekend, you'd go out with your fishing buddies, you'd be sitting there casting a line, and like, I don't want to be here. I'm not having fun. This isn't enjoyable anymore. And again, it's a hallmark of depression. We see it a lot in PTSD. We see it a lot in repetitive stress. But this is very different. Like, this wasn't a bad call that I'd had. This wasn't a sequence of bad calls. You guys have done a couple of really great podcasts on this. You know, Dan McGuire spoke really eloquently to it. I was listening to some old shows the other day. But this was different. This was like administrative PTSD, which I don't think exists. Maybe it does.
I think it does. That's why I left Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah.
And this is why I had shot Sam an email and said, hey, I think we need to talk about this. I think this is something, because then I started a good friend of mine on the East Coast who is very heavily involved with search and rescue has just been, you know, we'll talk about once a month, and he has a litany of horror stories about same thing, managing volunteers, email after email. And I think this is sort of the dark side of the volunteer experience that we don't talk about. So we're talking about it now. That's my that's my long intro.
I'm going to get right back to you, Dave, because I want to get your take on this. But Jamie, go ahead. You have a question.
Well, no, I just wanted to say, you know, I completely sympathize with you, James. My last years in my fire department here, which is all volunteer system here, were 4 years spent as the EMS secretary who handled all the insurance billing. Then I was the EMS chief for a couple of years, and that was it. I was done. I mean, I was fully baked at that point. I had no time to run calls and do all the things that I love to do, take care of patients, because I was doing paperwork constantly. And, you know, that's no fun. So yeah, I completely.
Oh, I can so relate, Jamie. Like I was saying, at the end of my ski patrol career, I was running the outdoor emergency care program for most of the western part of the state, and it's just not fun anymore. And Joe, you know, when I look at you, and it kind of leans into another question, you do so many things. You're a medical director, you're an ER doc, you're a USAR guy, search and rescue guy, you run your own business. Does that ever all make you crazy?
No question. And I really think that I think administrative burnout is a very real thing, especially when it, you know, oftentimes that tends to be people that do well in the clinical environment or the response environment or whatever, and they get chosen to move up and be in charge because they're obviously really good at it. And I think it's really tough on those folks. You know, you transition to where you do nothing but all the paperwork, and you spend all your time doing that stuff, and you miss the things that you really miss, and it will wear on you very quickly. I can speak to that from personal experience.
Yeah, it's like being a paramedic and getting promoted to supervisor without much training at all. That's not fun. Kyle, you got to have some thoughts on this.
Sam, I sympathize with everyone so far. Starting as a volunteer, like I said, in my career, amateur radio and ski patrol as well, between Michigan and then eventually in Wisconsin before coming to Colorado and getting a paid ski patrol gig. It was absolutely challenging. You know, being a shift leader on patrol came with a lot of additional duties, and all the patrols I worked with, all three back in the Midwest, they were all volunteer. And it was, it definitely, I could feel the burnout some days when it's like, you know, you start to wonder, you know, is this really worth it? Ultimately, I found that it was. I continued that in my career, professional career here in Colorado. Actually, that's what brought me out here. Is I moved out here to take the paid gig as a ski patroller. But as many of you have already shared, that as you know, as I was recognized as having an ability to plan and to lead others, and I quickly kind of rose through the ranks, as it were, to ultimately, my most proudest achievement is championing the medical planning for Winter X Games on behalf of Aspen Ski Company, specifically with Athlete Medical. It's, you know, once you arrive in that position, you know, even though it's a paid gig, let's just throw that out the window for a second. You know, it's the phrase, it's lonely at the top. I've never felt that more than when, you know, you're in those meetings and then you're ultimately having to bring those decisions back to a group and have to get buy-in and all that. And, you know, the administrivia and all that, there were days, I will admit, there were days where I truly wondered, you know, why am I still doing this? And it's good now that I've, you know, been able to have the support of colleagues and management and all that, where that ski patrolling, that's my escape from being on the desk at dispatch. So being out in the world and seeing that and kind of getting back to and reminding myself, this is what brought me out here, and that's why I love it so much.
Very nice. Becky, this is something you can relate to because you're a very big mental health advocate. Any thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Kyle just talked about kind of in relation to burnout is a really critical thing to kind of understand when you might be hitting that point, to understand, you know, who's around you that could be supportive. Do you have, you know, supportive coworkers and bosses who may understand, you know, what you're coping with? I obviously, being on the dispatch desk, I think I can't speak firsthand, but I would think comes with a whole set of kind of unique circumstances of hearing people at their absolute, you know, worst day. And I know Kyle has talked about that before, and that's got to take its toll. So I think that's just certainly something that people need to be, you know, really aware of and in tune with their own mental health and make sure they know when they might be hitting a critical point.
That's true. And I think that's a discussion topic of its own, because people don't realize what dispatchers go through. And I think that's a topic we should cover. So David, I got to ask you, people know, I think it was you that mentioned earlier, you know, when they kind of reach a burnout state, do people know when they should quit, when this isn't in their best interest or the best interest of the team to continue?
That's a good question. And I've stepped back from my team because I looked at people who had, you know, you wear out your welcome after a while. And it, even though people, you know, you may have a lot of experience, may have a lot to offer, but eventually we all turn into that old curmudgeon. And I didn't want to be that guy. So I finally stepped back before that happened, where it was still a positive experience for everybody, where I could leave on a good note. But some people, it's the only thing that they have in their life. And I was very fortunate where I had children. I'm 54 and I have a six-year-old, so I started late with that. So it gave me an outlet outside of out of Mountain Rescue. And when you talk about the administrative stuff, and I can only speak for our organization, it was very different. But as a leader, when we would have people come into, you know, they would still be doing their operational stuff, but also their administrative roles, I ensured that they owned what they did and let them do what they knew how the team was supposed to run. They knew what needed to be done, and it was theirs. You know, if you're the training person or you're the secretary or whatever, it was your deal. And when people take ownership of something and see how it betters your team, burnout is less likely. That was my experience. Instead of dictating, this is what you need to do, because then nobody wants to do it, especially if you're not getting a paycheck. So yeah, you need to step out probably 1 year before you think you need to step out, and also just letting people, you know, treating them as team members and letting them own it and grow it. And my philosophy the whole time was train your replacement, and I'm not going to be here forever, so make sure that the team, the legacy continues even after I leave or the next guy leaves or whatever. So that was my experience.
I think all of our goals should be, you know, to be Michael Jordan before he starts playing baseball, right?
Exactly.
Well, Dave, that's what I was going to ask you. You know, that makes a lot of sense, because if you're smart enough to realize you're not going to do this forever, you're going to have to want to leave it in good hands. So you need to groom somebody who you might see has leadership potential and isn't burned out. Yep. So at least you can walk away and feel good about it. I mean, when I left Ski Patrol, I was in charge of an entire region. I left my resort behind because I never had time to go ski, because there was always something I had to do, and I felt guilty about that. And it just was too much.
But this, I think, is where it gets a little bit tricky, because we have not had we have a number of members on the Tucson Mountain Rescue Team who are older but are still active with the organization. Not all of them are field active. Some of them are administratively active, do a lot in terms of command and control. And we have one member who has an absolutely encyclopedic memory of all the trails of the mountains around Tucson. As in, like, and he still comes out. He doesn't go into the field, but he will be in the rescue truck. He will be on incident command and be on the radio, and we'll have a team in a certain area, and he will say, "Oh, well, hold on, you're going up to that saddle right about where you are," because we have, you know, real-time tracking of the teams. He said, there used to be an old trail that went straight up there. It's kind of overgrown. It's not marked, but it should be about where you are. And sure enough, 10 minutes later, they'll call back and say, "Oh, yeah, we found the trail. Okay, we'll head up that way." And that sort of thing is invaluable. And so the question is, how do you keep from reinventing the wheel? How do you keep from having a team that's too young versus having a team that you have folks on who are talking about the way that we used to do it in the Carter administration? And that's, I mean, there's not an answer to this question, right? Because it's impossible. And it's just, but there's a flip side. There's institutional memory and institutional knowledge that when it goes, you definitely lose something.
That's a really good point. It's sort of, you know, when a language becomes lost because nobody takes it and writes it down, you know, that's a really good point. So everybody has value. I know I want that guy on the radio if I get lost. You can certainly tell me how to get back down, so that's not a bad thing. Anybody else want to reflect on that thought? Hello? Mr. Corbin?
Always happy to reflect on my own thoughts. So this is, and I'm coming to this. Obviously, this is two podcasts that are one podcast that's split into two. This is a tale of two teams, right? The team in Phoenix is a comparatively young team. It has a very defined structure. It has extraordinarily high entrance requirement. Well, I mean, not that high. They let me in, but having said that, and the team in
Tucson is a larger team in the sense that we have more members on the books. Tucson tends to be just by nature of geography and a couple other things, a very active outdoor town. So the mission tempo was a little higher. So you need more folks. You can pretty much rely on call outs. And this has changed a little bit with COVID, but at some point we'll get back there. But historically, you could rely on a call out on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, sometimes two at once. We had one with three at once. That happens every once in a while. And so you need a large enough pool to choose from. And, you know, most of these are walk-in. See how the person is. Give them some water. Give them some shade. Give them some food. You know, a lot of them need to be carried out, but some of them don't. We actually have a mounted search and rescue team with a pain horse that, you know, we can throw folks who can't walk out on their own but don't necessarily need to be stoked or littered out. And so you start cutting your roster at your risk. And so some of it is you have to look at your team, you have to look at the needs of the team, you have to look at, you know, no one of these things is unique.
Yeah, good point. Well, David, you know, he's talking about two different teams, and each team has a different composite of people. There's just a whole lot of differences between them, yet similarities. Is it a good idea to look at best practices from other similar teams for your team?
Yeah, it is, but taking it into context. And it was mentioned the Aspen team, and you know, there are some other high-level teams, and we looked at those things, and I brought in a lot of my experiences without pulling in a militaristic mindset into the team so much, but my experiences doing what I did at a fairly high level in the military and seeing what worked and what didn't, and then applying some of those things. So, yeah, stealing other people's great ideas is, I mean, that's how people and teams are successful, right? There's no new ideas. It's just how you implement them, but also understanding the context. And like James said, the Tucson team and the Phoenix team are the completely different animals. And to bring in the mentality of one team into the other, or the operational aspects or whatever, which would have been disastrous either way. It was a just totally different vibe. And both are successful in their own right and how they conduct their business. So it's a challenge. It's an experiment of one.
Well, you have to do it subtly, because just like with EMS, especially fire departments, they're not crazy about change. So anything you implement kind of has to be done slowly and subtly. Joe, you got thoughts on that?
Oh, I think you just said it pretty well, right? You know, I mean, we in EMS and this kind of stuff are not easy to change. And I think it's a huge culture clash between, as we said earlier, the volunteers who all have different motivations for wanting to be there versus, you know, those folks that may see it as a profession and are being paid for it.
Oops, exactly. Jamie, your thoughts?
No, I just think, you know, the idea of bringing in best practices from other units or other services or other organizations, and even outside of the search and rescue arena, is a good idea in context. I think that's the important point that was made. But I think it sometimes is important to look outside of the traditional responder community and look at what other volunteer organizations do, just to kind of get an idea of retention and how to keep people excited about what they're doing and focused on what needs to be done. Sometimes those ideas are, you know, other organizations thinking outside of the box come up with some good stuff that you can apply in context with your group.
That's beautiful, Jamie. I think that kind of puts us all in a nutshell. Kyle, Kyle.
Yes, Sam. And to dovetail on Jamie's comments, the volunteer search and rescue team that I had the privilege to be a part of back in Michigan, we took a cross team approach. So we actually utilized we were under the umbrella of emergency management. We actually received much of our training and team funding through the Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT, program. So we were cross-trained in that, and that opened us up to allow us to have some funding for equipment, like a trailer and communications, things like that. We also incorporated members from our local amateur radio emergency response team, so our Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Services group that provided our communications and that expertise, but also some of the local emergency management volunteers that were in the office, as well as members of our Sheriff's Office Mounted Patrol. And so what that really did is it provided those unique perspectives. And yes, there were a lot of type A's in there as far as personalities go. But what I think our strongest accolade was is that our team captain, Ron Miller, he came from the fire service as well as the military, serving in Vietnam. And he had brought back and he brought that mentality to the team. And he really honed that professional the feel of, really taking ownership of your time there. And so he was able to, demonstrate that every day that we trained or worked on a mission, instantly was able to kind of command respect from everyone there on the team and other agencies that we supported. And I think one of his greatest strengths is that he was willing to, as a leader and a demonstrated and established leader, he was willing to listen to the members, and he was willing to listen to opinions that didn't jive with his own. And through that, we were actually able to grow the team immensely. And I mean, all the way to even having volunteers with air scent dogs and their drones as well, assisting with rescues. And so we've been able to grow. We've been able to really to show people, that the team it's worthwhile to be part, because you don't just contribute, but you learn as well, and you got someone in the driver's seat who's willing to learn along with you.
Well, that makes sense. You want differentials, differentials and personalities and experience, but not to the point where they clash. And Becky, that kind of reminds me of you, because, you're kind of in a different boat, but you make a huge contribution, but you always walk away learning something from other people, and that's pretty cool. Any final thoughts from you tonight?
No, this has just been a really enlightening double episode here. And I always enjoy hearing about the wilderness expert stuff, wilderness search and rescue. Sorry, it's getting late, and I'm... starting to lose focus here.
You're an outdoorsy girl. You spend your time hiking and stuff, so that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I do. Pennsylvania is a little different than Colorado, and that it's not quite as sort of rugged and rural. But I've always felt safe. But it's always been comforting to know that should something happen, I'm confident that a team of experts would come to rescue me. But I certainly also be as prepared as possible. I was raised in Colorado, so I'm always prepared with lots of first aid kits and things whenever I head out into the wilderness.
Good girl. David, any final thoughts?
No, I'm good. I appreciate you having me on, and definitely gave me some things to think about personally. So I do appreciate this time.
Well, we appreciate you. This was actually an excellent mix of people with similar yet different experiences. Mr. Corbin, final thoughts from you.
Only two final thoughts, maybe to set up for some future episodes, one of which is talking with my friend who's running SAR out in Maryland. He was talking to me about how their board, so our board, and actually the board of all the whether it's EMS or search and rescue teams I've been on, have all been members of the team. Their board is a corporate board, and it actually has members from the community, from outside. And when he first told me that, I was like, can you do that? And he said, yeah, most corporations have people on their board who are not involved in the corporation. That's how you get an outside perspective. And that, which I mean, I've don't have a lot of business experience. And that was an aha moment. I said, that, you know, that's brilliant, because a lot of the debates we get into are these really minutiae, ridiculous debates that if you bring someone from the outside, they'll say, but does this actually really matter? And that's the thing that sometimes breaks the fever. And you realize, no, it actually doesn't matter. So I think that's worthwhile talking about. And then finally, most teams I've been on are cash rich and manpower poor, person power poor. And there is an enormous resistance to bringing in paid personnel, whether on a part-time or a full-time basis, to do some of the administrative tasks that really is the nidus of what we've been talking about here, right? This is the source of burnout. And I think that is a bubble that needs to be popped, because, again, I can speak to the stuff that of a couple of teams I know about. They're not hurting for money. Money is not the problem. The problem is volunteer involvement and getting people out and retaining personnel. And so I think a discussion about, is it worthwhile investing some of the money you have, not in equipment, not in training, but in someone to come in and do the stuff that you don't want to do? I had a friend once in a different context say, put your money where your stress is. And that was very like, put your money where your stress is. And if your stress is in those administrative tasks, does it make sense to bring? And the problem is volunteer organizations are enormously resistant to doing this because they're volunteer organizations. And as soon as money come in, it somehow dirties it. But I think that's a discussion we need to have. And I think that's maybe a taboo we need to break.
Well, make a note of that and send it to me so I don't forget, because every time I talk to you and have you on, you got 14 other great ideas to talk about. So you're going to be with us forever, I think, but that's okay. So, Jamie, this is one podcast I really don't want to wrap. This has been an awesome discussion, but I guess we got to go because it's after Dr. Joe's bedtime. So, you know.
That's all right. You know, and I'll tell you, Joe, talking about all the various types of organizations out there and the types of different training that they have to do to be ready for that call, it just reminds me of all the various things that Paragon Medical Education Group does to prepare organizations for disasters and various types of responses that you're able to help them with. And I think that it's important for people to know that you can help just about any kind of first response, disaster preparedness, rescue organization out there with coming up with the best type of training for their organization.
Well, we certainly hope so, although I'll have to say I think the comments on the paying people to do the administrative stuff because nobody wants to do it and that's where your stress is absolutely brilliant. And I'm going to remember that for a long time. So I don't know how we incorporate that in training, but it's certainly worth telling people about.
Definitely is. If folks do want to find out more about what Paragon Medical Education Group has to offer for them and the unique customizable training options you bring to the table, where can they reach you?
Well, we would certainly want to talk with them so that we can indeed customize the training to fit their needs. They can reach us at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, or always to the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. James, where can folks reach out to you?
Yeah, folks can find me on all the normal channels under Wilderness PA. I am the most active on Twitter right now, but I'm also on Instagram and Facebook.
Excellent. David, how about you? Is there a place where folks can catch up with you and see what you're up to?
And I'm going to jump in for David. He just texted me that he had to jump off and take care of that six-year-old that he was telling us about. David is on Facebook and Instagram on SafeMind. And it's a really good page to follow. There's a lot of really good situational awareness self-defense and the crazy 2020. It's really good channels to follow. So SafeMind on Instagram and Facebook.
Thank you very much. Becky, how about you? Where can folks find out what's going on the weather side of things as things will be continuing to heat up in the tropics?
Yeah, absolutely, Jamie. Twitter at WX_Bex, LinkedIn, Becky D. Podwin, just like it sounds. And as always, on the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
And we always appreciate following what you have to do in there. And you know, people, if you have comments for Becky or Kyle or any of our experts, leaving them in the Facebook group is a great place to do that. Tag them, and people jump in there and get answers very quickly. So it's, we always appreciate our experts and our team members here that take the time to do that. Kyle, how about you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media channels under the handle WXKyleNelson. Feel free to follow along with me there, connect with me on LinkedIn or in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group to continue the conversation.
And last but certainly not least, Sam Bradley. Folks want to follow you and see what you're up to. Where can they do that?
No, I was just thinking, when Kyle gives an answer, it's a book, which is pretty cool because he gives them a lot more information than they expect. So that's pretty cool. I will be in all the places aforementioned under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 and in our ever-growing Facebook group as well as disasterpodcast.com. Jamie?
Yeah, and you know, everywhere under the handle Podmedic is pretty much where you can find me. And of course, over at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group and disasterpodcast.com, where if you're on any of the episode pages there, right below the audio player at the top of the page, you will be able to find links to subscribe to the show using your favorite mobile apps on your whatever your device, iOS or Android. Go ahead and click those links. It'll automatically, for the most part, sign you right in. So everybody take care and do that when you get a chance. But Sam, good episode. I know Dr. Joe had to jump off because it is technically late as we record here. But this has been a great episode to double up on here.
Yeah, and I noticed how previous conversation about volunteerism kind of floated into this one. So it was kind of a good thing. I think we kept that continuity going. But one thing I learned in this podcast is administrative burnout is not our everyday burnout.